and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. President Trump has again pulled back on tariffs he imposed on Canada and Mexico. He's holding off until April 2nd with the 25% levy on imported goods that comply with a 2018 trade agreement. CBS's Scott McFarlane.
These have direct impact on auto workers, on the providers, the contractors, the private companies that help serve the automakers, and, oh, by the way, the auto workers.
A setback for Elon Musk's SpaceX Starship vehicle after being launched in Texas. CBS News space consultant Bill Harwood.
The rocket then flew out of control and broke up in a shower of debris that was captured by spectators as far away as Cape Canaveral.
Cuts by DOGE have affected at least 18 federal departments and agencies. Big cuts are expected at the Department of Veterans Affairs. Combat Army veteran Rob Hamm is concerned.
We should rise together. When we as a country send people to war, we have a sacred obligation to take care of them when they come home.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
James here, host of Unlabeled, your 90s mixtape, every Sunday from 8 to 9 on WFHR. It's your weekly dose of music, nostalgia, and pop culture exclusively on locally grown radio.
Wisconsin gets the win. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Men's college basketball. The Badgers beat the Gophers in Minnesota. Matt LaPay on the Badgers Radio Network.
Inbounds pass to Tanjay. They'll let him dribble out the clock, and the Badgers make it 9 straight against Minnesota as the Badgers win it by 7. Final score tonight, Wisconsin 74, Minnesota 67.
John Blackwell with 25 points. The Badgers 21 for 24 from the free throw line. That's the best in the nation. Great guard.
You know, you get on the road, the fact that we were able to really be solid with the ball the second half and get to the free throw line was really important.
Marquette with a loss at UConn, 72-66. The Golden Eagles host number 6th-ranked St. John's on Saturday. NBA, the Bucks over the shorthanded Mavericks, 137-107. Giannis scoring his 20,000th career point.
20,000 points is, obviously, when I go on the court, I'm a competitor. I'm going to compete. That's who I am.
It's Giannis Antetokounmpo with Sports on Mike Clemens.
It's game day every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday on WFHR's Playmakers. Thanks to local businesses Quality Plus Printing and Family Natural Foods, you can join us 5 to 6 with your calls, sports takes, and ramblings. Covering local sports like no one else.
Clearing it out, and it is almost caught.
We'll have breaking stories, game day conversations with players and coaches, and you. 5 to 6 Monday, Wednesday, and Friday on WFHR's Playmakers.
Get out of here!
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about today. Everybody on Tuesday, catch Idiocracy Live. Anybody? Anyone catch President Camacho giving his macho speech? Because evidently America is back, baby! And as I watched, I was waiting for cannons, and I was waiting for the pyrotechnics, the light, the house chamber. I was waiting for the show, man, because that's what we got a bunch of. It was political theater at its finest. It was feeding the base their red meat, and my mind kept going back to are we back? Or are we a hellscape of Biden dumpster fires? Because, you know, the speech kept blaming Biden for everything. And while simultaneously saying everything's wonderful, I thought it was very bizarre kind of way to do the deal. But understand, the folk who this was aimed for, it hit home. Went after Democrats, blamed Biden, all that stuff. And puffed the chest, little thumping. What you got is you got Texas Democrat Al Green got thrown out. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and a bunch of others walked out. The smart ones didn't even bother showing up. But again, what you saw was a very disorganized response from the Democrats. No united message. I thought Senator Slotkin did a good job in responding as if it were 1996. But understand, the Donald did not disappoint the base. And Democrats have got to figure out how to go, You're lying. And yo, look, we were lied to for 100 minutes. There were 100 minutes of lies. This guy is a used car salesman. This guy is selling you a chocolate-covered... he's selling you a chocolate-covered turd, man. Up is down, front is back, day is night. And again, the mastery that is Trump. And this is, you know, this is sincere. Here is a guy who is the ultimate finder of the positive. He sold during that 100-minute speech, he sold people on the American dream. And that he was the guy who was going to bring it back. And, you know, the polling kind of shows that. Look, the CBS YouGov poll that I was just taking a look at. Say that, you know, the people who watched it, obviously, 74% said he was presidential and entertaining, because that's what I want out of my president. I want a song and a dance. I want a number. I want to be entertained. I don't really give a rat's behind about the policy. I don't care about what he's going to do. I just want to laugh. And I'll be honest, I kind of did at the number of lies and the delivery of them as if they were actual truths. Now, interestingly enough, 76% of the people polled who watched this 100-minute comedy show say they approve of Trump's address. 32% said they disapprove. Again, that should tell you who watched and who didn't watch. Because, as they said, a majority of people who did watch were Republicans. Only about 27% were independents, 20% were Democrats. So are we surprised? Now, 2/3 of the people who watched said that they believe that Donald Trump spent a lot of time speaking about their issues. You know, immigration, war, and the economy, the tariffs. 69% said the speech made them feel hopeful. 54% made them feel proud. Because, you know, we're back, right? How can you not be proud by being back? And what we saw was, you know, people who were somebody who was a bully. And evidently that's who America is now. We are backing the bully. Of the people who were polled, 77% said reducing federal spending and waste. That was their number one issue, 77% of them. You know, fire those government workers. Immigration was right up there, 77%, ending the war in Russia, 73%, and imposing tariffs. And this is the one that got me, 65% said the tariffs. So again, this is one of those things that Donald Trump has sold as the answer. This is the silver bullet. This is going to do it. And I'm someone who believes in tariffs as part of a plan, a well-thought-out strategy, not as the end-all, be-all, but as part of one of the clubs in the bag. Not something you decide willy-nilly, day in, day out. Today we have tariffs, today we don't. Well, we'll start over here. Maybe. Who knows where we are right now on the tariff front? Now, the most interesting thing, the biggest lie to me of the entire night, clearly was his talk about Social Security and the fact that, according to him, there are 3.6 million people between 110 and 119 years old collecting Social Security. He went on to say 3.47 million people between 120 and 129. And he went down the numbers. 3.9 million people from 130 to 139. 3.5 million from 140 to 149. And here's the kicker. His words, and money is being paid to many of them. He says, but a lot of money is being paid out to people because it just keeps getting paid and paid and paid, and nobody does. It hurts Social Security. He goes on to say, people 150 to 159, there are 1.3 million of those people still lining their pockets. 130,000 people over the age of 160. And then he completely jumps the shark. 1,039, not 1,038, not 1,040, 1,039 between 220 and 229 years old. One person over 240, and another over 360 years old, still collecting. He said, but we're going to find them. We're going to find out where that money's going, and it's not going to be pretty. His words. Now, understand, Social Security's only 190 years, it was only 90 years old, not 190, 90. It was 90 years ago. The first recipient, Ida Mae Fuller. She was born in 1874, 151 years. So you could say she's 151 years old, but she's been dead since the 70s. What they want you to believe is Ida Mae still collected a paycheck and cashing it. Now, what they're trying to tell you is Ida Mae's family are thieves. And what they're trying to tell you is you're a thief because there are all these millions of people, millions of people who are dead, still collecting paychecks. And what that's saying is you are still collecting granny's checks. You are out there lining your pockets with a 360-year-old person's checks who never paid a dime into the system. Country didn't even exist at that point. But that's what they're selling. And he said it. I mean, this is the amazing part for me. Said it with the straightest face. Like, they're doing this. There's all this fraud. It's everywhere. It's rampant. 360-year-olds collecting Social Security. And we're going to go get them. And I'm like, go ahead. There's a good job for Pam Bondi and her minions. In fact, you know, send Doge Boy and his ferrets to go find them. Because they don't exist. But what they want you to believe is the whole system's corrupt. So when they come to you and say, we're going to privatize it, you go, yeah, good idea. It's not. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, as I said, surprising, you know, 2/3 of the people who watched the speech said Trump spent a lot of time talking to issues that they cared about. And one of them, as I said, tariffs. 65% of the people in this poll said tariffs were something that spoke directly to them. And what's interesting, if you watched Idiocracy Live, what you saw is Republicans were uproarious in their applause for everything, except when Trump talked about tariffs on Canada and Mexico. There was a noticeable pregnant pause, a noticeable looking around of what? Interesting moment. Go back and check it out. But here to share some thoughts on what these tariffs might do, what they might look like, if they're going to be in place in 5 minutes, maybe tomorrow, who knows what's the plan. I've asked my good friend Scott Paul to share some thoughts. Scott's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, great to be with you.
So I highlight this moment that the Republicans who all during the speech were, you know, just, you know, chanting USA and screaming at the top of their lungs, jumping up like teenagers at a pop concert. And yet that one moment of the entire 100 minutes of bloviating out of Trump's mouth, that one moment got Republicans just a little rocked on their heels, because I don't think they're on board with what Trump is doing on the tariff front. Do you get sort of a sense in that world?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. And the answer, of course, depends on which tariff you're talking about, right? And in this case, it was Canada and Mexico.
Right.
And I think it's fair to say that there is a little more congressional concern about the tariffs on Canada in particular, maybe a little bit Mexico, but more so Canada, because they've traditionally been a friend, an ally, a neighbor, have a close integrated trading relationship with it. Doesn't mean there's problems, but it just, like, is it the same as China, you know, right? And so I think that, and also, you know, and we've explored this a little bit, you know, there are still divisions within both parties on trade, right? And whether you think tariffs are a legitimate tool or if you want to go kind of all in on free trade agreements. And I do think that particularly some Republicans are still the adherents to that old philosophy, right? You know, of we got to be for free trade all the time. And they might be a little tough on China, but they're reluctant to, I think, speak out about some other issues. And it might be their relationship with the Chamber of Commerce or some of the global manufacturers or some of the agricultural concerns that are also multinational. Right? There's a number of reasons for it. But yeah, I noticed that too, that that's where one of the biggest gaps are, I think, between Trump and some of the congressional Republicans.
Because in my view, and look, I'm someone who believes you use tariffs as a tool to get to an aim. It's not the only club in the bag, but it's certainly one of them that should be used, and used with a strategy is my problem. So far in these 6 weeks, I haven't really seen a strategy. And I know my red hat friends say, no, Donald Trump's playing chess and he's 10 moves ahead. He knows what he's doing. It's not apparent to anyone else when you say we're going to throw all these tariffs off, and the next day you take them off, and we're going to throw more on, and oh, we're going to do this. It just seems chaos for chaos' sake without any real strategy, where I'm concerned that the rest of the world's going to tire of that very quickly.
Yeah, of course they will. You know, and for their domestic politics, they have to stand up and push back, right? I mean, they have to do that. Now, okay, let's go through an exercise here, because if there is a strategy, Rick, I'm going to tell you what it is.
Okay.
And I don't know that this
Help
is
me.
The strategy. But if there is a strategy, first on China, and I think that's the easiest one. You know, there are already an array of tariffs in place, you know, thanks in part to Trump's first administration, but also to Biden. And the effective rate of tariffs, if you looked at it, was about 10% going into Trump's administration. Now, they didn't cover every Chinese product, but the effective, you know, average tariff rate was about 10%. Now, Trump, you know, the one thing that he did do was put a 10% tariff on Chinese products last month. And so that was in effect. And so now you have an effective rate of 20% on Chinese products. And then with the, you know, with what just happened with Canada, Mexico, China, he added another 10%. And so that's 20% under Trump combined with the 10% held over previously. So that's an average tariff of about 30% on Chinese products. Now, that is going to cause some shifts in trade flows, and it's going to cause some production to move out of China. Whether or not it moves here, different story, but it's definitely going to move out of China. And so I do see this as part of the de-risking, decoupling strategy, and probably also a way to gather revenue. I don't know, to offset tax cuts or something like that. But I'm not opposed, I will say, to what he's doing with China. I actually, nope. You know, I'm okay with that, because there needs to be a reckoning.
No, and I'm right there with you. And we've talked about this for years. This is not new. It's not a new conversation between you and I. We've been having this for at least a decade now. This is not new, even to Donald Trump. This was right. Before. This was pre-Trump even. So I'm not jumping on a bandwagon. This is a place where we've been for a long time. But again, it's not the bludgeon tool that he's using it as.
Okay. Well, let's, before we go to Canada and Mexico and some of these other countries, let's go back to China for a second, because here's what I don't want to see him do. And I'm going to be very honest about this. I do not want to see him make a deal with China, because he tried that in the first term and said, look, I'm going to stop putting additional tariffs on if you buy some American stuff. And China said that they would do this. They literally never did.
Right.
They also didn't stop stealing intellectual property. And look, China's not going to change its behavior, no matter what they say. It's just not going to. The CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, not going to change. You know, they're all in on developing their national, you know, their national companies that have state ties and to getting in all of these new, you know, types of manufacturing, EVs or what have you. They're not going back. Okay. And it's just, so they might want to make a deal with Trump that says, hey, we'll buy some natural gas, we'll buy some soybeans, and you lay off the tariffs. I actually think that would not be a good approach.
I don't
know that China would do that. And I think it takes the pressure off of companies to then move out of China. And I think they need to. Now, so that's what I hope the strategy is on China. Canada and Mexico, I hope the strategy is this, that he looks at the performance of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, not what he had hoped, all right? And I agree. It hasn't lived up to what it was supposed to be. And just for your listeners' refreshment here, you know, this was a renegotiated NAFTA that was supposed to be more worker-friendly, more U.S. manufacturing-friendly under the last Trump administration, but that also Nancy Pelosi and congressional Democrats agreed with, okay? You know, it turned out, you know, our trade deficit with Mexico has shot up. There's just as many autos coming from Mexico that there had been. There has been a little bit of progress on labor rights, but it's still micro and not macro, I guess I would say. And meanwhile, China's been using Mexico as a backdoor to get goods into the U.S. market. And so you've had all these problems crop up. And so if he's using, like, you know, these tariffs to get leverage in the talks, I get it, right? I guess I can understand that. You know, the fentanyl and migration stuff seems a little far-fetched to me, I will say, because it seems like, you know, Canada and Mexico were already willing to do all of this stuff. But what is striking to me is that, like Trudeau's response, as you said, is, but, you know, he's like, yes, to stand up and fight back. Like, I'm going to put 25% tariffs on you. That's what the Premier of Ontario said, the same thing. We're going to fight back. Claudia Sheinbaum, on the other hand, was like, she's literally done everything that Trump asked, you know, on fentanyl, on turning over cartel, on stemming the flow of migration, and still has 25% tariffs.
And still getting kicked around.
Yeah, it's still getting kicked around. And so I'm like, well, what is the right response? I'm not entirely sure what it is. Now, if it, you know, I do not know that long-term tariffs on Canada and Mexico at the level of 25% is wise, given the integration that we have economically. That's not to say that the negotiations shouldn't happen on the USMCA or what have you, or that they, I mean, they might ultimately, these tariffs might ultimately be effective somehow. But I do know this, like, either Mexico or Canada can't withstand a trade war as long as the United States. Like, you know, we may experience some pain. They're going to experience way more pain,
right,
because of the size of their economy. And so I just, you know, it's one method to try to gain an upper hand. I don't know, you know, it's certainly not the kindest method. You know, and if there's not a strategy attached to this, then, you know, I don't know, right?
Yeah, you know, we've heard an awful lot in the media, especially foreign media, about America's soft power, mostly in conjunction with dealing with the Ukraine-Russia issue. But sure. I see this tariff thing, this is part of what America's soft power used to be. We're going to help your economy, you know, by giving you access. My concern becomes that soft power is all gone. And all we have left is a bully poking people in the chest. And I don't know the globe. And this is where I come back to, where, you know, leaders like Trudeau, you know, just to save face, you know, have to poke back. And I don't think that's good for any of us.
No, ultimately escalating this, it's going to impact people everywhere. And I say this as a trade hawk, right? It will have some impacts. I mean, I think that sometimes it's overstated about what's going to happen. And I think that, you know, some of the choice of passing a tariff along belongs to the retailer that's selling the good. Are they going to take a little bit of cut in profits and margins? Are they not going to, you know, buy back stock? You know, they got to make some decisions like that. They could certainly be more consumer friendly. They don't have to pass all of this along. But I will say this, and this is kind of in Trump's defense a little bit, okay? Is that, you know, and you're right, we utilize soft power. I think we utilize it very effectively in a number of different ways. I think on trade, we also utilized it. We gave away market access, and we basically gave away it for free. But we never held these countries accountable. And Trump is right about that. I mean, if you look through any of the administrations, whether it was Clinton or Bush or Obama, and even partly in Trump won, is that countries really weren't held accountable for unfair trade practices as much or as systematically as they should be. And we utilized the WTO and we did all the things that a good country was supposed to do. And a lot of stuff didn't change. And so, again, I don't know that this is the best answer, but it is an answer. And this is kind of why I'm not surprised why 2/3 of the people said, yeah, all right, I get why he's talking about tariffs, because most Americans probably think that we've gotten kind of a raw deal on trade. Yeah, we got cheap T-shirts. That's awesome. But our job quality is pretty terrible, and we can't make toilet paper in a time of need, much less missiles. So, it's a problem I think that a lot of folks can identify.
Absolutely. And it's something I wish Democrats would have, been talking about the last 20 years as we've here, been here. Talking about them. Right. I mean, this is not new to us. This is not new to our audience. But the reality is Trump has stolen the message.
Yeah.
I just don't know that he's the guy to bring it home.
Right.
Because I've looked at all the other bad deals. And you said a second ago, we gave it away for free, and I disagree with that. We didn't give it away for free. It cost, clearly communities their jobs, but we know who the benefactors were. And it's the Elon Musks, the Jeff Bezoses, the Donald Trumps. It's the oligarchs, the people who are running this country right now, who benefited mightily. Corporate America could not have been happier to move manufacturing out of the U.S. and into China with cheap, exploitable labor and lax environmental regulations. So, we did this to ourselves. So I'm not surprised, again, to your point, that 2/3 of the people were, this is an important issue to us.
Yeah. Yeah. And here's the, we can relitigate this. It doesn't really matter. Biden took some really strong and tough actions on trade. He did. Just never advertised them. Right. Because it was part of the brand. It was like, no, we're not going to talk about this. And so it was, so they never emphasized the fact that, how many people know that Biden put 100% tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles? I mean, that is a radical thing to do, but they didn't advertise it that much. But, again, Trump uses the State of the Union and is out there every day. And then there's a response to it. And so it generates a lot more than when someone else would do something like that. And you saw the strategy in what Biden was trying to do. And I articulated what I hope the strategy is, Rick. I don't know what it is.
No, we don't know. Yeah. And again, this is what evidently the allure of Donald Trump is, that he's unpredictable. And especially when, I'm now reading a lot of reports saying, get ready for the next recession, because this stuff, if it goes south, if Mr. Art of the Deal does not have a plan on the other end, we could see rising prices. We could see the standard of living in this country fall. Mm-hmm. And you rightly pointed out that other countries would hurt much more. But if you look at the last bout of inflation, other countries have hurt much, much more. And yet we're the ones who reacted in the most, one of the most crazy ways possible.
Yeah, no, that's true. And the goal of this shouldn't be to destroy other people worse than what's happening to us. That's I don't think that helps anybody. But, to the extent that we can remake and rebalance trade and do it in a way that's fair and that we're actually going to bring jobs back here, look, we gotta lean into that. Okay. And the response of Democrats shouldn't be just like, I'm against it because he's for it, right? Let's say what we could do better, right?
And pick it up and move it forward. This is what I wanted to hear from the Democratic response. The blind squirrel found a nut. Let's move that forward in a way that take it from the blind squirrel and actually turn it into something.
Yeah. Exactly. And if you couple that with, if he takes away funding for the CHIPS Act, right? You know, do you really want a bunch of half-built factories around the country? Like, J.D. Vance was sitting behind me. There was a big Intel factory, you know, scheduled to open in Ohio in like 2030 or something like that. I don't know that that would continue if there's no CHIPS Act money. So seems like seems pretty risky.
I've been told by my building trades friends that there are billions of dollars not being invested that we would have created jobs for their members. That's probably not going to happen in rebuilding our infrastructure. And I look at what they're doing with the broadband thing, which seems like a sweetheart deal for Elon Musk. Again, I'm not confident. But Scott, as always, appreciate the time. Keep up the great work.
All right. Thanks so much for having me on, Rick. Appreciate it.
Our good friend Scott Paul. Want to hear your thoughts. You think he's on the right track? Has the blind squirrel found the nut? Or do you believe he's actually got a plan? It's not just a bunch of blank pages in a binder. Want to hear your thoughts. Rick at the RickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Back after this.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Increasing clouds tonight, lows in the mid-teens. Clouds tomorrow morning, then turning mostly sunny for the afternoon and highs in the upper 30s. Even warmer temperatures for the weekend and into next week, highs climbing through the 40s, even some 50s. Current temp is 30.
Emergency medical unit, respond to 102 Maple Avenue, possible stroke victim.
When stroke occurs, you have 60 minutes to win or lose the race of your life. There are new treatments, but you must get to a hospital fast. If you suddenly feel weakness on one side, have trouble speaking, walking, or seeing, it could be a stroke. Call 911. Get to a hospital. Because how you spend the next 60 minutes could determine how you spend the rest of your life. Stroke. Know the signs. Act in time. A message from the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Tuesday morning, Donald Trump was up early doing the true thing. On the Truth Social site. I got to tell you, I spend a little time on the Truth Social site so you don't have to. Not a lot of truth. Not even much social either. But this is what Donald Trump truthed out on Tuesday morning. He said all federal funding will stop for any college, school, or university that allows illegal protests. Agitators will be imprisoned / or permanently sent back to the country from which they came. American students will be permanently expelled or, depending on the crime, arrested. No masks! Thank you for your attention to this matter. And I'm going, well, aren't illegal protests already illegal? And what's he talking about? Here to share some thoughts on maybe some insight. I've asked my friend Ken Mash to come share some thoughts. Ken is the president of the Association of Pennsylvania State College and University Faculties, APSCUF, the good union that represents the state-owned PASHE schools here in Pennsylvania. Ken, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, my pleasure, Rick. Good to be on again.
So what do you make of this early morning rant of we're gonna no federal funding for illegal protests or agitation? Or what do you make of this?
Well, you know, I was just talking to my vice president, Kara Laskowski, and she made a good point. And I think it's probably the case that he was concerned about all the events that were scheduled for yesterday, because AFT put out the call, and there, I think there were 2,000 events, both at public schools and at colleges and universities. And we had them on every one of our campuses, a very big rally and teach-in at Westchester University. And he was probably worried about it and was trying to intimidate people to get them to not show up, but it didn't work. And, I think there is so much on the plate. There's so much that's dangerous for college and higher education that we're going to have to push back on and that we have to make our students aware of, that we can't play in the arena of the cuckoo. So thank you, Rick, for what you do and paying attention to that stuff. But, you know, we really have to figure out how is it that we are going to effectively push back to save Pell Grants for students, to save the teaching of truth in classes where they have taken, you know, people who don't even understand what diversity, equity, and inclusion means have set about trying to destroy it. Yeah. So, and ultimately, it does come down to truth. And we have to protect the sciences and research, too, because there's been such an attack on research financially that major discoveries are not going to take place because universities will not be able to afford to run the research programs that they have. And that's going to have a trickle-down effect on the next generation of scientists. It's going to have an impact on the next generation of all faculty across the country, because all faculty tend to train at Research One universities. And so if that's not there, we are really going to have a shortfall of faculty members. I mentioned the Pell and other student loan stuff. If those students can't afford to go to college because Pell has either been cut or the gap that is projected is not filled, then, you know, this is going to spell doom for a number of programs and colleges across the country, privates included, who also rely on Pell Grants for students. So this is serious stuff, and we need to pay attention to it. Our members are fired up. You know, we put out the call. We are getting responses. We had a town hall that we announced, an online town hall, and we had 100 people sign up in the first hour to be on it. People are itching to do something.
This is where I'm thrilled to hear this, Ken, because what I've been saying from election night forward is out of the suffering, out of the savagery of what they're going to do. Look, bad things are going to happen. Out mm-hmm. of that is going to be an awful lot of organizing opportunities for people to come together, step forward, and fight back. And educators, I'm thrilled to hear that college educators are doing this, because, look, they're the first line. They're one of the first lines of defense in helping us, well, have critical thinking citizens so that we can continue this wonderful experiment of self-governance.
Yeah, one of the things that we talk to the students about is, you know, we're at a period of time where we can't rely on others to save us, right? We've been very fortunate that AFT, along with other unions and groups, has filed a number of temporary restraining orders and have been successful with virtually everyone that they have filed. That's all good, but it does kind of depend upon Trump obeying the courts, which we can't necessarily rely on.
Absolutely.
So, you know, there is no recourse. The recourse is each and every person.
Absolutely. So for me, I look at this, Ken, and, you know, the Orwellian aspect of these big lies on something called truth social is not lost on me. But I look at this quote unquote truth of him saying, you know, we're going to gut funding for all these colleges, universities and schools that allow these illegal protests. And I got to assume what he means is anyone who says bad things about it.
I have no idea what he means. There is a First Amendment.
Do you find it ironic during his whatever that was on Tuesday night that he talked about free speech being back and yet this is what he does?
Yeah, I mean, that it's preposterous that he would make such a claim, because he is trying to squelch free speech everywhere. And even when we get down to the broad statements that came out of the Department of Education about, you know, sort of what you can teach, that's how is that not squelching free speech? How is that not squelching the pursuit of small t truth, right? The very thing that they say theoretically that they want to protect. The reality is, you know, higher ed's taking it on the chin. I don't know how they blame higher ed for co-opting minds, because frankly, if that's what we were out to do, we would be doing a pretty bad job at it, because he would not be in the White House.
Right.
If we were, in fact, co-opting minds like he says that we are, but, you know, we're not going to fold. And we will be equally bad at our administrations, at least here in Pennsylvania, if they decide in any way that they want to obey in advance, because that's what authoritarians rely upon, right? They put the scare out there, put out that Truth Social, and then, you know, they're hoping that, you know, administrations at campuses will take action based on the threat. And we will come out as equally strong against any of our administrations that take that path.
Yeah.
But, what's an illegal protest? Like, what does that even mean?
Well, again, it's anything that he doesn't like. And this is why I wanted you to come out and talk about this, because when you set this kind of a bar, you know, anything that he wants, I guess, fits into that illegal kind of, because illegal protests are, you know, I guess already illegal. If they're illegal, right, they're already illegal, whatever that means. He didn't go into it into his truth. But it seems to me, and you know, as someone who has watched him over the years with his thin skin, that it's anything that questions him and his policies and what he wants to do.
Well, he should brace himself, because there's going to be a lot of people questioning his policies in the upcoming weeks and unfortunately years. But we'll do it as much as we have to.
Right.
You know, what's at stake here is not just simply higher ed. It's not all the things that he's cutting, but what is at stake is democracy itself. And if people do not stand in the way and stand up themselves, then we will not be living in the same country that we have known.
No, and this is where your members, this is where you guys have got to be the educators that you are, and to use this opportunity to educate. And one of the things that comes up, you know, I listened to Trump, you know, talk about and go down the list of wasted money on that Doge and the Doge ferrets have found. And I've seen all kinds of memes about, you know, there are turtles walking on treadmills and there's all this wasted research money. And yet when you find out and you read what they're actually looking into, a lot of it is stuff that will help us. So yeah, what they're doing is they're attacking the entire foundation of funding educational research and clearly universities and faculty. And I think that, you know, to be quite honest, is dangerous for us as a species, because a lot of the medical things that come up are because of some of this weird research.
Yeah, it looks weird. Like if you just look at the title of a paper, and don't even bother to read the abstract. And for those who don't know, these papers come with abstracts, which do a very short explanation.
What? It doesn't come with a YouTube video?
Yeah. So, you know, if you don't even bother to look at the abstract and you're just going to go off the title of it, you're going to have no clue. And you're absolutely right. A lot of those things that have been pointed out as, you know, sort of farcical, in fact, have real life practication or life saving application. And we're all going to be the worse for it. And, you know, one of the other countries have always pointed to the, you know, American higher education system as sort of the example for the world, groundbreaking, coming up with new discoveries, coming up with new research, you know, saving people's lives. And when that goes away, who do we turn to?
Yeah, I mean, when we're not the world's
Robert
leader.
Kennedy?
No, you're right. You know, when we're no longer the world's leader in research, who do we turn to? Do we turn to China? Do we turn to Russia? I mean, you know, this is the sad reality of where Trump and his rhetoric and Elon Musk and their little Doge ferrets, this is what they've presented us with. But I also see this a little differently. I also see this as an opportunity to educate. Much like you said, this is an opportunity for you guys to go, look, if you can't read the abstract, we'll tell you about it. It's an opportunity to say, look, this is us spending money in a way that's necessary. And I see this a little differently than some of my more liberal friends.
No, I agree with you entirely. I think there's too many people on the left, although virtually everyone who's not in Trump land is to the left at this point. Too many on the left who look at Trump supporters and are too quick to say stupid, right? And I don't agree with that. I do agree that they are very often ignorant. And that is I'm not saying that in a mean way. There's lots of things I'm ignorant about, but you know, don't really have the real information. So yes, that's part of what we do as educators, is to provide real information. And we have to work at doing a much better job at that than we have in the past.
Yeah, I go with over misinformed myself.
Right, that's fair.
Ignorant, there's a negative there. I go with over misinformed. You just have the wrong information. But even that tells me that even if you gave them the right information, would they believe it? And this is where the sad world that we're in when you're talking about education. The experts, the so-called experts in our country, are again being questioned as valid. And that takes us down a really bizarre place when you're now questioning whether education is worthwhile, whether critical thinking is still there. It's a weird time.
It is a weird time, and and again, when I used the word ignorant, I wasn't implying anything mean. Like I said, there's lots that I am ignorant about. I could not go do surgery. I'm ignorant about how to do surgery. But you're right, the messages have to go out, the information has to go out, but it also has to go out in a way in which people are able to see the underlying argument and are asked questions. In other words, you can present information where you're actually asking questions of people for them to explain how does it work. To explain, and I think there's been some, unfortunately, too late explanations of things like tariffs, where people can start to see like, oh, okay, that's the downside of it, right? How is this going to work and actually be better for people? And I'm talking about tariffs in the ham-handed way that the administration has imposed tariffs. So you're right. There's a way to communicate that information, and that's part of our jobs, is to figure out what's the best way to get through it.
Yeah, my fear again, and I can't emphasize this enough. This kind of ridiculing, research. This is scary to me because it is part of our entrepreneurial spirit. It is part of the innovation of this country, and I fear if you cut that off, if you kill that, as I believe they're trying to do. This bodes poorly for us and for our children into the future. And that's one of those things I've said this a million times. The one thing that came out of the pandemic that I hate more than anything is hearing someone tell me to go do my own research. And what they mean is watch a YouTube video instead of doing actual research, the kind of stuff that your members do.
Yeah. It's dangerous. The great social scientist Earl Babbie talked about reality, how people know things, right? And we can know something by actually experiencing it, seeing, touching it, and tasting it. That's how we can get to know about it. But the other kind of reality is agreement reality, and it's actually more than what people can experience in their lifetimes. And that is what we just sort of agree as a society is going to be, is true, right? Small t, true. And, how do you get that kind of information? You can get it from reporters. You can get it from others who have experienced it. You can get it from researchers who are viewed as experts. But the minute that you have a breakdown, and we are experiencing a breakdown in agreement reality, it really sets things up for, almost an explosive society, because people cannot even accept the terms by which we accept that things are real.
No, and it's where we are. And that's why, again, I finish here where I started, where your members and educators are so, so vitally important in this moment, to where as the bad stuff happens, and it's going to happen, as the suffering happens, and it's going to happen, out of that comes the organizing and the solutions on how we move forward. And we do need people. We do need educators. We do need experts to move the movement forward, so to speak. But Ken, I appreciate you taking some time for us, sharing your thoughts and expertise. Great stuff.
My pleasure. Anytime, Rick.
Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Are you worried about silencing students on campus, faculties on campuses, because they may say something bad about Dear Leader? Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Or is this just another, it was just a Tuesday? Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1857. That was the day the U.S. Supreme Court handed down one of its most infamous decisions. It was known as the Dred Scott case. Dred Scott had been born into slavery. He was owned by a military man named John Emerson. His military service brought Emerson from the slave state of Missouri to the free state of Illinois and then the free territory of Wisconsin. While in Wisconsin, Scott married. Emerson's career path then turned back to Missouri. A few years later, Emerson died. Scott attempted to purchase freedom for himself and his wife. When he was not successful, he took his case to the courts, claiming that his time on free soil should have granted him freedom. The Supreme Court decision was devastating for Dred Scott and for all who opposed slavery. In a 7-2 decision, the court ruled that as a black man, Scott had no claim on citizenship under the U.S. Constitution. The majority opinion left no ambiguity, saying Scott, quote, had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. But the court went even further. It ruled that the Missouri Compromise of 1820 was unconstitutional. This meant that, according to the court, Congress could not move to prohibit slavery in any U.S. territory. Reaction in the North by those who supported free labor was swift and angry. The Chicago Daily Tribune declared, "It is the first step in a revolution which, if not arrested, nullifies the Revolution of 76 and makes us all slaves again." The Dred Scott decision sharpened tensions over the question of slavery and marched the nation closer to civil war. Today's Labor History in Two brought to you in memory of Carol Hillman, a passionate friend of workers and volunteer of the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So a new survey put out by the folks at Data Progress, Data for Progress, and the Blue-Green Alliance. They found a bipartisan majority of folks that they surveyed support neutrality agreements for workers and employers. And this is one of those things that working people have needed for a very long time. Look, I've been saying, if you want to reunite this country, you got to reorganize it. You got to reunionize. You got to give people the ability to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, and that unions aren't ideological right or left. They're about fighting for those better wages, hours, conditions. And I think, you know, voters understand this. But what the folks at Data for Progress and the Blue-Green Alliance found out is 63% of the people that they reached out to support union neutrality agreements. Now, you may remember there was this thing called the Employee Free Choice Act, EFCA. This was something that Democrats thought that George W. Bush would pass, would sign, something that George Miller back way back in the early 2000s thought was, hey, this is a way to get, you know, bipartisan support for, you know, a little labor reform. And it had three parts, you know, card check being part of it, a labor neutrality agreement, the idea of going to the employer and saying, hey, we've got some support, recognize the union, start bargaining, let's get a contract. Also in the Employee Free Choice Act was first contract arbitration and some teeth when employers break the rules, when there are unfair labor practices. And it was moderate reform. It was a step in the right direction. It wasn't undoing the damage of Taft-Hartley, but it was moving in a better direction. So those three things, remember, you know, net neutrality, you know, there are card check, employee neutrality, first contract arbitration, and some penalties for breaking the rules. What you saw on Tuesday this week is Josh Hawley, along with Bernie Moreno of Ohio, and Senators Cory Booker and Jeff Merkley, New Jersey and Oregon, two Democrats, coming and signing on to and introducing this this piece of legislation to make, well, that one part of the EFCA law, and they call it the Faster Labor Contracts Act. And what that would do is it would simply amend the National Labor Relations Act and require, you know, workers who have voted to form a union and employers to begin bargaining with within 10 days. There's a framework with if there's no agreement within 90 days, it would be referred to mediation. There's a stipulation in there. If the mediators fail within 30 days or additional periods to solve the debate, then it goes to binding arbitration. And there's a whole bunch of, you know, things that you could argue back and forth on that. It is a step potentially in the right direction for labor. It's also potentially something, depending on who's in the White House and who appoints the arbitrator, that could be a negative. But it is a step in a direction. So on Tuesday, this is what Josh Hawley does. Now, me, I'm leery when a Republican puts forth a piece of legislation and we're told that it's supposed to help workers. My Teamsters union is 100% all seems the leadership is 100% behind it at the international level. Supposedly, they're putting a lot of political muscle and capital into this. Well, on Wednesday, you had a number of Democrats, Bobby Scott, and a number of Democrats, along with one Republican, Brian Fitzpatrick, and Bernie Sanders in the Senate. So you can say it's bipartisan, that reintroduced the PRO Act, the Richard L. Trumka Protecting the Right to Organize Act, which, you know, part of me goes, that's great. You know, it's this is what Democrats need to do. Get out there and fight for something that's going to make lives better. But it got me thinking about the Secretary of Labor, who is going to be Trump's Secretary of Labor, Lori Chavez de Remer, and her statement that, you know, she only supported the PRO Act when she was in Congress because she represented Oregon's 5th Congressional District. And it wasn't really something, you know, it was a flawed bill. And she only supported it so she could have a seat at the table. There's part of me that goes, I look at the Hollies and the Marinos and some of the Republicans who may sign on to the Fast Labor Contract Act. And I think this is one of those moments where they're seeing the writing on the wall. And one, they got to get on board with the fact that labor is high on people's approval rating list. That workers understand that the way to a better life now is through organizing, is through a contract. This Faster Labor Contract Act, while I think it's better than nothing, I'm questioning. Again, I go back to it's better than nothing, but it doesn't do anything on the front end to stop employers from harassing and intimidating and committing unfair labor practices. It does none of that. There are no teeth in that part of it. And it also relies on the fact that they think that the National Labor Relations Board is going to be functional and be able to do any of this stuff in the era of Trump. So it takes a lot of things for granted. And this is one of those things. Now, me, I would like to see the Protecting the Right to Organize Act passed. It undoes a lot of the bad things from Taft-Hartley, getting rid of the right to work status. And says, look, you know, if there's a contract in your workplace, you've got to pay to service that contract. None of this freeloading. You don't have to be a member. You don't have to join the union, but you got to pay for the service that you get of negotiating, enforcing, and all of that of the contract. There are no free riders. But I'll tell you this, and this is where there's something positive to come out of this moment. Labor, while it's at historic low numbers right now, there is an appetite for stronger labor unions. There is an appetite for higher union density because, well, nothing else is working to raise wages. There are no benevolent corporate interests. They don't give anything. You got to fight for it. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM, W248DE Wisconsin Rapids, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. President Trump delays some tariffs on Mexico and Canada to April 2nd. On a phone call today with President Trump, Mexico's president said he changed his mind on tariffs after she shared some good results against fentanyl trafficking. CBS's Adrian Bard.
Estamos teniendo resultados, Presidente Trump.
Citing a drastic reduction in fentanyl trafficking, Mexico's president convinced President Trump to postpone tariffs. She shared U.S. Border Patrol data showing much less fentanyl entered the U.S. in February. The Mexican leader described the talk as very cordial, but asked rhetorically,
pues ¿cómo vamos a seguir cooperando, colaborando?
Why Mexico would cooperate in the face of measures so damaging to its people. Adrian Bard, CBS News, Mexico City.
The U.S. and Canada remain at odds over retaliatory tariffs. With a memo showing the VA plans to slash tens of thousands of jobs,